Hello and welcome to Big Ideas. I'm Paul Barclay and you're on ABC Radio National or listening via our website. Glad you could join me. Today, Julian Assange and WikiLeaks under the microscope. To his detractors, he's subversive, a revolutionary intent on undermining national security and deserving of incarceration. Even some argue the death penalty. To others, he's a hero, flushing out the secrets and lies hidden from us by less than transparent governments. But what does Julian Assange stand for? Does his background and upbringing provide us with some clues to his political philosophy? And what's the real agenda of WikiLeaks? ABC journalist Andrew Fowler has been on the trail of the elusive Julian Assange. His biography, The Most Dangerous Man in the World, is literally hot off the presses. So much so, I was forced to read a proof copy of it. Last Thursday, I spoke with Andrew Fowler at the Avid Reader bookstore in Brisbane. Julian Assange, meanwhile, is in the UK on bail, fighting extradition to Sweden over rape charges. WikiLeaks, the organisation he fronts, is still basking in the glory, or infamy, of some of the most extraordinary leaks. Video footage showing a US military helicopter shooting civilians and journalists in Iraq, the Afghan and Iraq war logs, and hundreds of thousands of highly confidential US diplomatic cables. He's a cause célèbre to many on the left of the political spectrum, but his own political views are less clear-cut. How does his biographer Andrew Fowler assess the enigmatic Julian Assange?
He's charismatic, extremely intelligent if you believe that IQs determine how intelligent you are. He apparently has an IQ of about 170, which apparently makes you very intelligent. The problem that Julian has is he's very intelligent, but he doesn't know quite what to do with it. So he ends up in awfully difficult situations. Mm. His relationship with people tends to be a bit on the rough and ready side. I mean, he's humble, he's arrogant.
Narcissistic, perhaps?
Narcissistic, this has been... I'm asked before... I mean, he's a journalist, so... I'll leave it up to you to decide what you think of that. I mean, there's a degree of narcissism in many things that we all do in our business. And so, yes, I mean, to that degree he is. But he's also very pleasant, very amiable, very open. You don't get a sense of that in him. I mean, hopefully in the book some of it comes through, some of the contradictions, because it's not easy to nail him down as one particular person. It's certainly not easy to nail him down from a particular political perspective. You say he's on the left. And yet, in fact, he's quite a libertarian. He's living at the moment in the house, in a mansion, 10-bedroom mansion in Norfolk, with a libertarian, a right-wing libertarian, as he would describe himself. And so here's Assange, got a lot in common with this guy, Vaughan Smith, and they get on very well because they both agree that big government is a problem when it keeps secrets that the public has a right to know about. That's their common ground. Mm. Maybe on social issues it's different. So it's quite difficult to get a handle on him.
No, it's very true. On the left, people often see the state as the saviour, the state as the solution to the problems that we face. Assange very much sees the state as the problem, not the solution, to be subverted at almost every opportunity, doesn't he?
I think the word subvertive is a good word to use because he actually started an organisation called the International Subversives back in Melbourne, where he was maybe not the starter of it, but he was part of it, and certainly a leading light, as he will tell you. He is a subversive. Mm. And I may ask that question, so what's wrong with that? I mean, we don't have subversives, people who actually challenge enough, and I think as a journalist, we are almost like professional subversives, at least we should be, I think.
Do you feel like you spent enough time with him to really get to understand him? You had a few sessions with him, didn't you?
To get to understand him. I mean, I like him at the moment. I haven't spent enough time with him, quite clearly.
Because he does burn people, doesn't he?
I think he burns people. And he burns them because he doesn't get the fact that, you know, you actually do need a bit of space and, you know, he's not always right and you're not always wrong. And that's a problem that Julian has. He thinks, I mean, he is the smartest person in the room. I mean, even in this room, he may well be the smartest person if he were here. And you should have him here if he actually gets away from the various charges he faces. He's terrific. I mean, you know, to answer your question, I can't say more than that.
He is also a father, not what you'd call an involved father. It's even unclear just how many children he has, yet he did, early on in his life, fight a rather bitter custody battle for his son. The marriage broke up. He was up against the authorities, sort of social service type authorities, I think.
It was.
Any sense that there lay the seeds of what was to come in terms of his view that the authorities couldn't be trusted and that, you know, you really had to try and undermine them yourself?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question. Absolutely. I think that it does stem from that experience. I mean, Julian had a very rickety childhood, and we can talk about that later, but on that specific point of trying to get custody for Daniel, they tried desperately to get custody for his son, who had been removed from him and was in the custody of his then-wife. And the fighting, the brawling that went on was quite bitter. And what they discovered, this is as Julian and as Christine, his mother, tells it, through freedom of information request into the court, family court, they discovered that there were some terrible things that were done and things done in the name of, she says, to paraphrase her, like Nazi feminism. She felt that that there was a feminist, fascist streak in the family court that was denying men the right to have access to their children. And she plays that card very strongly, and she says that that is the thing that motivated Assange to really try to expose the wrongdoings of government.
Mm, because he wasn't close to his father. His father left early on. He was very much a product of his mother's upbringing.
Sure.
She's a very influential person in his life, isn't she? An anti-authoritarian figure herself.
She's anti-authoritarian, absolutely anti-authoritarian. And I mean, she's one of the few people you can actually meet who say that they went to the anti-Vietnam War demonstrations in the 1970s. It's where she met her husband, and yet she wasn't opposed to the war. She wasn't there to oppose the war. She was there to watch the passion of the spectacle.
Mm.
Now, I thought that was pretty interesting.
Unusual, yes.
Unusual is the word I'd use, yes. So here he's growing up in this environment where he's exposed to all these different people, all these different ideas, and his mother has these rather unusual political perspective. So, yeah, I mean, that colours him in that way politically. Probably explains why he seems to be an amalgam of the left and right.
His early years are fascinating. He apparently, as a boy, gets caught up in the scandal around the notorious cult, The Family. Mm. His mother moved in with Keith Hamilton, who is said to be the son of Anne Hamilton Byrne, the leader of The Family.
Mm.
Is that confirmed or speculative?
Yeah, look, it's speculative, and you've got the early draft of the book there. It's a bit smoother in the other one. The guy who actually she had a relationship with is Christine and had a child by, and that's the reason that they were eventually on the run, because this guy, Hamilton Byrne, was chasing them.
Mm.
Okay, so that's why they're on the run, and that probably explains why he's a difficult childhood with fear of being snatched in the night. I mean, having his half brother taken away from him. But Hamilton Byrne and that cult in Melbourne was as close as you can come. And I don't like using the word evil. It's got all the connotations of, you know, religious sort of business. But it's as close to evil as you possibly could care to get. I mean, it's just terrible what happened to those kids. And if this guy was in any way involved in that, then she really had a lot of things to be worried about.
Mm.
And it certainly was her fear at the time that he was involved in that, and they were on the run from this quite extraordinary and vicious cult.
He was chasing them?
He was, indeed. He was trying to get his son back, as he saw it.
Mm.
So this is a children of, you know, this is a story of a struggle over kids. I mean, how many times do you hear that?
Yeah, and she had to keep one step ahead.
Absolutely.
Of him. He went to an enormous number of schools as a result, didn't he? And at a young age, we know how important stability at school is, how most of us view that for our own children.
Sure.
That disruptive childhood's got to have been a major factor in his life.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I'm falling on the side of psychology. As a journalist, I just prefer to try and deal with the observable facts as we can get them out. But surely, yes, that would have had a big impact on somebody growing up. I mean, how do you survive that? How do you make your way in the world, having been chased halfway around Australia by somebody who could well be completely crazy? You know, with your mother, who's got rather curious ideas about life. And, I mean, I'm not saying that Christine's, you know, crazy. I'm just saying she's got rather unusual perspective on life. And you come out, you've got an IQ of 170, you're reading philosophy at the age of 8, you know, you're writing computer programs, you're just a genius. You are a genius. You stand out everywhere. How do you make friends? How do you connect?
Mm.
Difficult.
Yes, and he was, at a very early age, able to write and understand complex mathematical coding for computers. This led him, at a young age, into hacking into some incredible high-level institutions that he had no right to be able to be roaming around in via his computer. Give us an idea of some of the early adventures of, of Julian Assange.
Paul, there's nothing wrong with wandering around Los Alamos nuclear facility and having a look. I mean, I asked Julian, I said, you know, he said, look, what we do is we go in, we just we break in, we enter, we look around, we don't do any harm, we don't change anything, and then we leave. I said, so you know you did no harm? He said, yes, absolutely. What do you think, I am a fool? Mm. I said, well, I'm not sure. That's not actually what I was asking you. I mean, how can you be sure? How can you be sure? I said, all air-gapped, Andrew. They're not building weapons there. It's all theoretical science. It's nothing to do with the actual atomic system. I said, oh, okay, so that's okay. And he said, well, that's what that's our morality.
How old was he when he was hacking into these institutions?
18, 19, and he finally got busted at 19. And bragging over the phone, yes, as you do about breaking into institutions, because you can't wait to tell your mates, even when you know the federal police already know that you're on the game, mm, because you've read the emails that say, we're chasing Julian Assange and the international subversives as they're inside the ANU computer, looking for another whatever wonder, and they see this, and they still carry on. And he's bragging, saying, you never guess what.
He couldn't control himself. Hubris got the better of him, didn't it? And as
absolutely
a result, he was prosecuted in the courts.
He was prosecuted. But if you believe Julian, he, although he admitted the offences, he wasn't guilty.
Mm.
It's difficult to understand, isn't it? I found it a little difficult to I asked him, I said, Julian, no, you actually admitted the offences, but you weren't guilty. That's right, because I wasn't guilty, because the law was wrong.
Mm.
He said, if you notice, Andrew, the law changed afterwards. He said they actually changed the law. So had he committed the offences later, he would have been innocent and not been charged. So if you follow that, that's the kind of person you're dealing with. And he has an extraordinary, what you might call a moral compass, which can either hedge you out into the open sea or straight for the rocks.
Mm. Mm. Now, it was about this time he got involved with the cypherpunks, a play on the term cyberpunk. Do we know much about this? Was this really the beginning of his understanding of the political power of the leak?
I think what the cypherpunks did and what they did to Assange was to bring to focus his concern about the intrusive power of the state and the right of the individual to privacy. Now, this is really important because the separation between those two things is fundamental in understanding Assange. And very often people say, hang on a second, you've got a problem here, because you're saying you want privacy, but you want disclosure of public records. And he said, and what the cypherpunks did was to say, we have a right to our privacy. We have a right to be private individuals. And we have a right to send communications without the government being able to read them. We have a right, if you like, to say, send a letter and not a postcard. A postcard can be read by the postman if he fancies it or she fancies it. A letter is more enclosed and more difficult. You've got to steam it open, or so I'm told, and pull it out and try and read it if it's good handwriting. So that's the difference, and that's where cypherpunks came in. For him, it was a defining moment, I believe, in actually determining his view of the world and where he saw the way in which a democracy and the way in which individuals can live inside a democracy. That defined him. They ran it. They had these extraordinary communications networks, sending material around the world. The American government at one time wanted to introduce a very low encryption process where you couldn't send material around the world without it being read by the CIA, for example. So what's wrong with that?
Mm.
Everyone wants their email read by the CIA. I mean, I hope they're reading mine. I don't think they are, though. That's the problem. So it's that position of him looking for the perfect answer, and I think in cypherpunks that's what he found.
All this is really the entree to the main course, and the main course comes, I think, last year, the collateral murder video.
Sure.
I don't know how many of you here have seen it. It's footage that WikiLeaks obtained from US military helicopters in Iraq, and it showed civilians being shot at and killed. And if you've seen it, you'll never forget having seen it. Remind us of that video and the power of it, and you know, what sprung from it.
Well, 2007 in East Baghdad, there was some sporadic fighting going on, but the Americans had some gunships up and they were circling a group of people that they identified as being armed. Now, certainly some of them appeared to be carrying guns. Certainly that is certainly possible to see. And they took the view, this is the pilots, in this I'm speaking in a very somber way about how they were discussing this. I mean, you watch it, it's pretty appalling. But that's what the people do when they're having to kill people. They tend to make it funny and black humour and whatever to survive the emotional impact of what they do. And they zoomed in on this group and they just opened up them with 38mm, I think it is, shells, and apparently that just destroys the human body. It's not a pretty sight. They blew these people to pieces. Among these people that were walking in the street with these guys who may have been carrying guns were a couple of Reuters journalists. One of them was killed instantly. The other one survived. And the most chilling part of the whole film is when you see the second part of it, when this guy is lying on the ground, Jamal, and they are saying in the helicopter gunship, they're saying, reach for the gun. If he reaches for the gun, reach for the gun. Because if he does that, then they can kill him. A van pulls up. People get out, as you do when you see someone lying in the gutter bleeding to death, to help. And the gunship just opens up on them and kills the people inside. A couple of kids inside survive, but the Reuters journalist is killed. And it's as close to, well, looks like murder to me. I wouldn't have called it collateral murder. I may have just called it murder. Mm. That's the collateral murder story.
Mm. He didn't just, well, WikiLeaks didn't just leak the helicopter shooting's footage either. It was interesting. They contextualised it. They edited it. They massaged it a bit. Mm. They put a quote from George Orwell at the beginning of it. So it was not just raw footage being pushed out there to make of what we like. No. They were very much, as journalists do, in a way, presenting that information to the public, weren't they?
Sure. No, but it was, in my opinion, if I may express an opinion, it was overly heavy-handed. Mm. But what Assange says is, and there was an argument inside WikiLeaks about should they call it collateral murder or should they just put it out the way it was. And Assange said, I'm committed to maximum political impact. When people send us material, I guarantee them they risk their lives, we'll give them maximum political impact. And that was the argument that he ran, and since he usually gets his own way, that's what it was called, collateral murder. But the fallout from that was, of course, everybody said, hey, why are you calling it collateral murder? And the debate then became about that and not so much about the second part of the video, which shows the killings.
He came to Australia about that time, didn't he? And
got
held up by the federal police in customs. He was very edgy around that time, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Very, very nervous. He understood the power of what he'd unleashed or was about to unleash.
That's right, Paul, yeah. He did understand that. He understood that collateral murder had caused him some problems. And he came to Australia, and when he came through customs, I mean, the federal police did the right thing. They took his passport away. They photocopied it. They saw where he'd been. They already had the electronic records of where he'd been, but they had the actual stamps in passports in places that don't have electronic registration, so they matched that up. And they let him go through. But the trouble is the feds also got caught going through his bags on the roundabout. Now, Assange says, oh, well, I just think they were just doing a random check. And I thought, Julian, I said, what is this? I mean, how can you believe that it's a random check? You've just had your passport taken away for 20 minutes, and they said it looked a bit tatty. I said, oh, really? Okay, well, sure. He said, yeah, but it fell in the river once, Andrew. You understand that? I said, yeah, but sure. I took it away, and then they gave it back to you, did they? And they said, that's right. And they said, nothing wrong with it. They said, that's right. I said, good, okay. And then you saw the federal police going through your bags out on the carousel. When you approached them, they said, oh, we're just having a look through your bag. You know, it's not. We just want to sort of check things out a bit, nothing particularly. Mm. And they mentioned, I forget exactly the words, but something about his past activities. And still, there's no red flag in Assange. I mean, this is extraordinary naivety.
Were they looking for something, the federal police? Were they looking for a copy of that video?
I don't know what they were doing. What were they doing?
Looking for generally suspect material.
You just say, you know, you get it before it goes through the baggage carousel. You do it on the other side, out of sight, out of view, and you can go through everything there if you want. I don't know what they were doing, but not so much the federal police, who were kind of doing their job, but it was Assange's reaction. It was like he didn't believe that he was really under surveillance. He thought it was all right.
Mm.
He's quite naive. It's that naivety. It's the kind of naivety that would allow you to take on the most powerful nation on earth.
Yes.
I mean, who in their right mind I mean, well, you know, who would go and do what he did? I mean, it's just absolutely extraordinary. And I spoke to one of his friends. He still does have friends. I mean, I don't want to paint him too much. He is a loner, but he does have people who kind of, I think, look after him and put up with him, you know. I said, this is equivalent to being blindfolded, going across an 8-lane highway in a pouring rain. Mm. That's what you guys are doing. And I said, it's crazy, you know, but you have to be crazy to do it, and you are. And they are.
It's very hard to overestimate the impact of that, and it was obviously a harbinger of things to come. He had more in his back pocket, more trump cards. About a year ago, I had a great conversation right here with Washington Post journalist David Finkel about his terrific book, The Good Soldiers. Mm. Now, it's claimed in your book that he and the Washington Post had seen and quite possibly possessed the collateral murder video footage before WikiLeaks got it. In fact, maybe a couple of years before they got it. Mm-hmm. David Finkel does refer to this footage in his book, but significantly, no questions were asked about that footage by either David Finkel or by the Washington Post. Mm. It was never released. Mm. Are you critical of them for not releasing it? Should they have released it?
If they had it, they should have.
If they'd seen it, should they have followed it up?
Yeah, there are two things. I mean, firstly, had they got it, they should have given it to Reuters because Reuters wanted it and they had every right to have it. They're the employers of the killed journalists. What they should have also done, regardless of whether or not they had the video, I mean, they had David Finkel's transcript, which is an exact word-for-word rendition of the conversations in the cockpit. And you can follow, you can look at the video and read his book and track the words around the back of the buildings when they lose sight of the guys in the streets. Washington Post should have looked at that and investigated it, and they didn't do that. Oh. They didn't do that. And I think it shows how far we've come from the days when that would have been investigated and now it's not. And the same goes for, I mean, while we're at it, you know, the New York Times as well, yes, have done a number of things that, you know, we're journalists, we are not arms of government. Our role is to be separate from government. We get too close to them, we get embedded with them, it's a problem for democracy.
You're tuned to Big Ideas on ABC Radio National with me, Paul Barclay, in conversation with Andrew Fowler, journalist and author of The Most Dangerous Man in the World, a biography of WikiLeaks frontman Julian Assange. You can post your thoughts on this discussion on our website. Just search ABC and Big Ideas, and I'll try and read some of your comments out next week. Some have compared Assange to Daniel Ellsberg, the former Pentagon insider who leaked the so-called Pentagon Papers, which exposed how the US was conducting the war in Vietnam. But interestingly, as you'll hear in a moment, Ellsberg was disappointed with some of Assange's whistleblowing methods. Let's head back to the Avid Reader bookstore in Brisbane and a conversation between myself and Andrew Fowler. Next up, the Afghan war logs, a huge US military leak which revealed the extent of civilian deaths and the increase in Taliban attacks.
The Afghan war logs were huge, and they were also the biggest mistake that Assange had made at that time, because he named people in these war logs, and he named the villages. And we don't know whether or not people died as a result of it, but the first rule is that you should not, if you're trying to reveal a war that you think has gone wrong, you don't want to kill more people. Mm. Having said that, he was, of course, castigated by everybody who hated everything else that he'd done. He said, you see, he's revealed the names of people. What a treacherous bastard he is, you know, blah, 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 treason, shoot him, you know, take him out. These are the very people that have been, you know, invading Iraq and doing all sorts of other things. The United States government throwing rocks at somebody who...
No, but they weren't the only people criticising him.
No, Amnesty International did, too.
And Daniel Ellsberg.
And Daniel Ellsberg.
His hero.
He did, indeed.
Released the Pentagon Papers.
In fact, read my book, it's there.
Yes. How did Assange respond to that criticism from somebody he looked up to so much?
Well, he said he wouldn't do it again. Mm. He wouldn't be a naughty boy again, he told Daniel Ellsberg. He said, we'll get it right next time. And Ellsberg said to me, well, so they did. In fact, the Iraq war logs, which followed it, were so scrubbed clean, they were even cleaner than the military records that were put out at the time by the United States. So he did get that right. But then, of course, Julian being Julian, the next thing he does is revert to type. Mm. And he puts out a document which lists the strategic targets that the United States government deems to be very important to protect, including a huge gas pipeline in Russia, a serum laboratory in Australia, I think anti-venom investigative area, and the main cables that enter Australia from the United States, their location. And Ellsberg said, why did you do that? And he said, well, what's wrong? It's public information. And Ellsberg said, yeah, but you're giving a hand to the terrorists here. You're actually, you're pointing the way. You're giving them the coordinates. And he said, well, no, I don't agree with that, you know, blah, blah, blah. So, and Ellsberg just said, that ruined it. That wrecked it, I think was the expression he used. And it's just that, you know, Ellsberg wanted so much everything to be fine and dandy. He wanted it so much, and yet he's a logical, clear-thinking person, and he realised the damage that had been done. And if you'll notice that Ellsberg now repeatedly says that he has more in common. In fact, he has a lot in common with Bradley Manning, who's the guy who allegedly did the leaking. And that's a bit of a shift of emphasis in Ellsberg.
Well, yes, and Ellsberg is a Harvard-educated Pentagon insider who turns against the Pentagon in the 60s when he sees the lies that are being told to American citizens. He is actually quite a different person, totally different person, actually, to Assange, isn't he? So Assange is always an outsider, never an insider.
That's right. And Ellsberg has been in both places. And that's interesting because the insider who's now the outsider, they are the whistleblowers. They're the people that are, and they're thrown out of the centre. And they tend to be damaged either by, either the reason they've left is because they're damaged by the centre or they're thrown out and damaged as a result of that. And so that's what happened to Ellsberg. Now, Assange has never been, as far as I know, on the inside, apart from when he's wandered around inside various American facilities. But if we talk about this particular issue of being an insider and being an outsider and being a whistleblower, one of the things that WikiLeaks has managed to do has been to make it easier for people to leak, okay? So you're inside a big organisation, you've got the goods, you're a bit upset with the government, you decide that public interest to press the button and get the stuff out, and you do that. Now, the problem is, when you send that material out with WikiLeaks, they don't know who you are, make a point of not knowing who you are. Now, there's a whole debate about whether Manning knew Assange and that relationship. It's murky, okay?
Yeah.
It's very murky. But the point is this, is that whistleblowers need to be managed. You can't just take the goods and run. And as a journalist, they need human comfort, they need guidance, they need support, they need reinforcement, they need to be told it's going to be all right. They need to be told that you'll protect them. They need to sit down and have a drink or a cup of tea and a chat, and usually for far too many hours while you hear every detail of their tortured lives spilled out to you. But they need that, and they do need that. And what we had in Manning, if Manning was the leaker, is somebody who desperately needed that. So he ended up reaching out to, of all people on the planet, Adrian Lamo, who was a piece of work and a half, who purported to be a journalist and apparently gave protection to Manning if Manning was the leaker. And the rest is history because he dobbed him into his mates in the military intelligence.
I'm not quite finished with this issue of transparency and the limits to transparency, really. I mean, here we have someone who believes that the state cannot be trusted and information that the state has about it oppressing its citizens or whatever should be released for the public, and the public should make up its own mind. However, as you've pointed to, if people get identified in the process in sensitive war zones, there's a problem. Now, the executive editor of the New York Times, Bill Keller, just said on a NPR interview that I heard that in the early discussions about the Afghan war logs with The Guardian and The New York Times, who we know published those war logs, Assange was told that they wanted to edit out the names of the Afghan citizens mentioned in the documents. So he was told in advance that's what they wanted to do. His initial reaction was they didn't need protecting. This is what Bill Keller says. He became very upset too when the New York Times decided not to link the WikiLeaks site to their website because that site also identified the citizens. Is this consistent with your understanding of Assange and the difficulty he has understanding that transparency can have a cost in human life, potentially?
Yeah, I mean, that's a big question, and it's a very important question. And the relationship with the New York Times and The Guardian is not a pretty sight. not a pretty sight at all. And Assange was treated appallingly by the New York Times and by the Guardian. But that, by the way, I mean, Julian does bring things down upon himself very often, and that's the problem. Mm. But to go to your question, I'm really at a loss to really, to get to the answer.
You were saying that you think he has learnt, though, from the Afghan war logs?
Yeah. I mean, Keller is just dancing on a pinhead with this. He's just saying, we tried to do the right thing, and Julian wants to just publish and be damned. I mean, Julian wanted to do what I thought most journalists did. Get the document, put it on the table, and say, we'll publish everything. We'll try and take some names out. We'll reduce it. And what David Lee from The Guardian was saying was, and I mentioned this in the book, he said, Julian just wanted to put it all out and then work out what they could take out. Well, I thought that's certainly what I do. Mm. I don't try and work out what not to put in there. I try and work out what to put in. And it seems that they were trying to have it both ways. They wanted to be able to have Assange as the source to take information, and they wanted to distance themselves from him as a journalist. In the New York Times case, particularly because of the problem they have with the First Amendment freedom of speech, and there are links to all sorts of other areas there, but that's a problem they had. Mm-hmm. Look, Paul, it is a difficult area. I think that the New York Times published wonderful material. It's a great newspaper. I mean, I read it. It's fantastic. But there's an organisation called Task Force 373. Now, what really upset Assange was that this was a CIA hit squad roaming around in Afghanistan, killing people. Now, The Guardian thought it was a big enough story, put it on the front page. Der Spiegel put it on the front page. The New York Times, I couldn't find mention of it. Mm. It appeared later on. Now, that monumentally upset him. He said, look, how come you... Because this is a naive view. Mm. Whereas Keller says, hang on a second, we had 9/11 down the road. We have a different audience to appeal to. We've got different problems. But that's not what he says when he argues about Assange. He brings up this stuff about, Assange wanted to keep the names out, and we put the names in and we didn't. But that's not the argument. The argument's about the New York Times basically not doing its job in disclosing information that's in the public interest, and Assange was monumentally pissed off about that, and I think he was right to be.
To Cablegate, now the Cablegate. 650,000 or so diplomatic cables that were obtained by WikiLeaks. We remember some of the embarrassing revelations for the Australian government that came out of that, I'm sure. Only a very small proportion of those cables has actually been published up until this point. Isn't that right? 4,000 or so?
4,100 at the count in February when I stopped counting.
So more explosive stuff to come, do you think?
Well, maybe, or maybe they've picked the eyes out of it. But, what Ellsberg called it was the zombie lie. It's the lie you cannot get rid of. And that is that they dumped 650,000 cables out there and didn't redact the names, and so aren't they bad? Whereas, in fact, you're right, it's 4,000 or so that have been released. And they're all being released by The Guardian, mainly. I mean, The Guardian's doing the work, and Assange, and they're just feeding the stuff up to him and up to The Guardian. The Guardian are doing it. So you've got this really bad blood relationship between The Guardian and Assange, and yet they're still working together. Mm. Because, actually, Assange understands that you've got to do things even when you don't like people you're working
with. They need each other in a way, don't they?
Well, it sounds like journalism to me.
Yes. the impact of Cablegate, actually, and WikiLeaks leaking these documents, could you argue that the leaking of those documents played a role in the changing of government in Tunisia, for example?
Well, certainly Bill Keller, Julian Assange's great friend, does say that. He says WikiLeaks did make a difference in Tunisia. And I talked to a friend of mine on Le Monde, and she was North African editor for Le Monde, and she said, absolutely. I said, is it right? I mean, Keller's not just sort of, he's actually right about this? And she said, absolutely. Mm. People did not believe the Americans would not intervene in Tunisia. That when the American ambassador said that Ben Ali, the president, was a crook, and was, stacking the public wealth away in his private institutions, they were surprised that the Americans believed that, because what kept them from rebelling against Ben Ali was the fear of the Americans. And then, of course, the dominoes fell across the border.
And this emboldened the protesters, knowing the American attitude toward the Tunisian government.
I mean, if you fear an F-16 flying down your street, I mean, you will stay indoors. And that's what they worried about, and quite rightly so.
And what would Assange's view of that be? This is coming really to how he understand his politics. Would he see that the cables ended up changing a government as part of the intent, or is it just you throw that stuff out there and what happens, happens? Is there an agenda behind the leaks?
Yeah, there is. There is an agenda. It's difficult to pick, but you've got to say this, that he actually did target North Africa. And in fact, he targeted Le Monde. He pulled Le Monde in. I mean, a lot of things going on that really upset The Guardian, like he was sort of, they had an agreement with Julian, and then he'd sort of go and change it, you know, and say, oh, I just thought I'd change it, you know. Anyway, he pulled Le Monde in, and he pulled Le Monde in, the print version, because he wanted to make a change in North Africa. He thought, we got this stuff, we'll drop it with them, and it'll be, you know, it'll be great. It'll make a difference. We'll make a difference in the world, and that's what he believes journalists should do. Mm-hmm. I debate that with him. I did talk a lot to him about that. I didn't think that journalists necessarily needed to actually, you know, institute regime change themselves, although I wouldn't mind changing a few regimes myself. But I thought it was best to have a sort of broader policy of disclosure, which was, you know, less of a problem. And he picked Le Monde and pulled them in. And, of course, Le Monde is banned, has been banned in Tunisia since my friend was kicked out in 2008. And so it's pointless. He pulls Le Monde in and they're useless. But what happens is, the material goes out on WikiLeaks. It's picked up by Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera put it through. It picked up on Twitter, and it goes through the social networks on Facebook, and that's how the information got out. So, if you like, the grand architect that Julian was in getting the print edition of Le Monde to sort of read by the elites, of course, in Tunisia, if it's read at all, not by the people who took to the streets in the end. Mm. It was a straight case of the electronic media that did it for him. In fact, it was WikiLeaks. It was the old model. It was the computerised leaking system.
Mm. So Assange's politics are difficult to pin down. He's not a traditional lefty. He's got some libertarian tendencies, maybe some anarchic tendencies as well. I wonder, with the attitude towards WikiLeaks, are they likely to be as enthusiastic about leaking material that could potentially harm so-called progressive causes? Or is there any hint that they would self-censor if material of that nature came to them?
Good question. I would think that there would be a debate, I mean, between Julian and whoever's around at the time, about whether or not to release that kind of information. But they do have a policy of complete disclosure. I mean, the policy is, OK, we believe in open disclosure. Well, so do journalists. But journalists also say, but hang on a second, this actually is not that important. Julian would say, no, everything. Everything's got to be disclosed. And so, consequently, you end up with that position where, you know, they'll be saying, well, should we be doing this if it's actually going to harm someone doing some good work? No. We have a harm minimisation process. Mm. I mean, it sounds like managerialism run riot, doesn't it? You know, harm minimisation. It's the sort of thing we have at the ABC, isn't it?
Yes.
So what you do is you put the stuff out, but then you make the phone call and say, oh, by the way, we've just revealed the nuclear codes on the web. You've got about 20 minutes to change them. That's harm minimization. Mm. I mean, I think it fails to accept that journalism is subjective. Mm. It's like trying to deal with that in a very sort of mechanistic fashion.
It's interesting that apparently the New York Times is considering setting up its own version of WikiLeaks right now, site for whistleblowers and leakers to deposit documents. But unlike WikiLeaks, they would be screened by professional journalists, perhaps those with expertise in the subject. Mm. What do you think about that sort of model?
Well, look, actually, that was the idea that Assange came up with last year sometime. He was talking to me about it. It's the thing that OpenLeaks is now running, which is the guy who's written a book about his life, which I describe as a victim impact statement, really. So it was a cheap joke, and I'm sorry about that. And the idea is that you download the stuff, not to a central authority. It's far more democratic. It goes out to your institution, and then you then send it off to them, and then they process it and send it back. It's all secure, so nobody knows who's the leaker and the rest of it. But the thing is that if you don't publish, Julian's idea was, if you don't publish it in 3 months, you know, then we out you and we say, you've had that top story and you've sat on it and now it's the public domain and we'll publish it. Mm. So to go to your answer, yeah, I mean, this is the New York Times, may well do that. I mean, I think it's a great idea.
Well, it shows how WikiLeaks is influencing mainstream journalism,
absolutely,
doesn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. It does indeed. That's, in fact, where we're heading. We're heading to this kind of process. And I can see that Foreign Correspondent, Four Corners, would have its own little button, and you just, anybody out there wants to leak a secret, you know, just press that button and down it goes. And then you'll see it on Four Corners in, you know, a couple of months or so. So that's the idea. That's the idea.
Yeah.
Which seems sort of simple. I think it's, and I think it could be effective, but it's not. It's Assange's idea, and it's, you know, we should respect that as his idea.
Assange and WikiLeaks have been able to obtain so much information that the best newspapers and the best investigative journalists in the world have not been able to get their hands on. Does this say something about the failures of mainstream journalism, and has this embarrassed some of the world's most august media organisations?
Thank you for the question. I mean, I think what it does is it clearly shows that journalism has failed for a variety of reasons. I mean, without going into the history, just look at the evidence. Look at the cables that have been released and match against what was said publicly at the time with the cables, and they show what the government actually knew. And if you now believe anything the government tells you before they launch a foreign war, you need to read some more books, because clearly governments manipulate all the time, every moment of the day, to reduce the political impact of the decisions that they make and to take the people with them, such as a democracy. I mean, I happen to believe that the best thing for a democracy is not more careful and more secretive government, but more a more open institution. Because if the governments aren't more open, and if we don't know more about what they're really up to, we will become more cynical about our democracy, and we shouldn't be. We should be robust, and we should be demanding the government. We shouldn't let them get away with it, which is why when WikiLeaks releases its information, you just say, this is the evidence that you require that says we should do a better job, and we should really not let politicians get away with what they get away with.
Do you accept that governments should be entitled to keep some secrets from the public?
Oh, yeah. I do. Yeah. I mean, obviously, they do need to keep maybe one or two three things secret, but but mainly not. I mean, you look at the stuff that's been published. This is secret. Secret. You can read secret cables. How many people have died as a result of secret cables? I think two ambassadors have lost their jobs. That's about it. I mean, it's as though we need to understand that when we vote a government in, we are actually part of the government. We can't just absolve ourselves and say, you guys do it, and then we'll criticise you. We'll all be cynical. No, no, no. They do it. You tell them, and you tell them you want to know, and you're big enough to be able to make a decision to say, we're going to go and fight a foreign war. We're going to go and kill people in a foreign country. We're going to go and bomb them. That's what we're going to do. Let's not shilly-shally about this. But, of course, they do shilly-shally because they're frightened of what the people will do.
What about the argument that WikiLeaks could make the world more secretive and less transparent, that governments will now go to greater lengths to keep information from us?
Sorry, excuse me. Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's certainly Daniel Ellsberg's fear. And it is that the sacred First Amendment enshrining freedom of speech in the United States, something that Julian Assange completely trips up the right-wingers with by saying, I want to bring freedom of speech and the right-wing, the First Amendment to the whole world. They say, but hang on a second, you're a dangerous left-winger. So he wants that. And I do seriously believe that he does want that. It's something that he fears, Ellsberg fears, and I think he's quite right, that the reaction against the exposure of American duplicity, the price you'll pay for that will be some attempt to restrict freedom of speech in the United States. And in that way, you know, Ellsberg's saying, I think you went too far. You should have been more careful. If you'd been more careful, maybe the tiger wouldn't be out of the cage. Maybe we could have actually got the information out without stirring up so much anger against you.
Has Julian Assange broken any laws, committed any crimes that you've been able to identify? The Espionage Act is one that's often pointed to as perhaps being in breach of.
My understanding is the Americans can't prove that. I think they cannot prove that he's in breach of the Espionage Act of 1917. If they could, they would have tried to extradite him from the UK, because it's by far the easiest place to get people out of. Probably you can snatch them from Italy, but I think that if you're going through the legal process, Britain is a very easy place for you if you're an American administration to extradite from. So the answer is no, they don't. But it probably points to, if I could just make this point, one of the reasons why Bradley Manning, who's the so-called leaker, is being treated so abominably and being held in solitary confinement 23 hours a day and being forced to stand naked at times in his cell, is because they're trying to break him. They're trying to prove the link to Assange. If they can do that, then they can pull Assange in as being a conspirator. That's what they're about. I'd expect that. I mean, that's a normal process. What breaks Ellsberg's heart is that, you know, he said, I heard him, there's some logs that were written apparently by Bradley Manning, in which he talks about what he was prepared to do and why he did it, and he was prepared to lay down his life for what he believed in. He said, I thought that was just ridiculous he'd write that. He said, until Bradley Manning's now been charged, and part of that, he possibly faces a death penalty. Mm. That's where we are.
What do you make of the Australian government's and Julia Gillard's stance towards Julian Assange? Is the Australian government toadying to the US on this?
Toadying. Mm. I mean, it's so third rate. It's just it's not even toadying. I mean, I'm a bit croaky, but I mean, I must say, I viewed this from overseas because I was sort of, you know, holed up in London flat waiting for Julian to surface in Norfolk and what have you. And I was reading this stuff and I'm going, oh, come on. I mean, really, Rudd came out and made a statement. And I was talking to Guy Rundle, who's got a piece out in the Monthly, which you should never read before you buy my book. So, and we're having a chat, and we were saying, we were in a pub, and we said, that is definitely Rudd making a bid. He was in Cairo, and he started talking about, no one will take away the passport of Assange. To answer your question, clearly Julia Gillard should have said something a little more clever. Mm. Clearly she should have said, he's an Australian citizen, you know, we will protect an Australian citizen. I mean, I don't know who's advising her, but I mean, it's just bad advice, whatever.
What's the latest with the charges that Assange faces in Sweden over the alleged sex crimes? Do we know where that's up to at the moment?
It's still an appeal. I think he's still resisting the extradition to Sweden. It's kind of not ironic, but it's kind of Julian. It's very Julian that he goes to Sweden because of the laws that are enshrined to protect his organisation. You know, it protects... It protects organisations that disclose information. It protects sources. It's everything for him. It's wonderful. It's great laws. It's wonderful Sweden. The problem is there's a whole set of other laws there that deal with human relationships, which are based on the same premise. And, you know, looking at it from a distance and just looking at it and saying, you know, Julian, how did you manage to get yourself into such a pickle? And I just say to him, you know, I said to him on the way out of the manor, I said, you're here not because of the CIA. And he agrees it's not the CIA who set him up with a couple of chicks. I mean, honestly, half the audience wouldn't be safe if Julian was here tonight. He's very charismatic and he's very alluring. I mean, he's charismatic to men as well. I mean, it's not a sexual thing. It's like, but with women, it clearly is. And so he ends up in Sweden and he ends up in bed with a couple of women inside a couple of days. Well, you know, I mean, that's what Julian does. Apart from also challenging authority, bringing down governments, you know, and the rest of it. I'd said, well, how do you get the time to do all this stuff? You know? And I said to him, you know, on the way out of the door, I said, you know, this is just about you being a chick magnet, I said to him. And he smiled. He said, it's just about revenge, you know, Andrew. I said, all right, okay, well, I've got to go, you know, and I left.
It's been great talking to you, Andrew. Terrific. Thanks very much. If you can give a round of applause to Andrew.
That was Andrew Fowler, ABC journalist and author of The Most Dangerous Man in the World, a biography of Julian Assange, talking with me last Thursday. The book is published by Melbourne University Publishing. And if you're curious about the title, it refers to Henry Kissinger's description of Pentagon whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg as the most dangerous man in America. Ellsberg himself was asked by ABC One's foreign correspondent if he was once the most dangerous man in America, did that make Julian Assange the most dangerous man in the world? To which he said, yes.